everyone. I'm still Scott Bill, and I've been doing my PhD with Resolve for the last 3.5 years, developing scenarios to 2030 to explore how UK household consumption might change and the carbon intensity of that. And I won't say too much about the kind of methodology of scenario planning, scenario building, and so on. What I'll do in the sort of 20-minute slot that we have here is to try and focus on the outcomes and some of the key issues and concerns that led into the scenario process and which come out of it, as well as giving you a summary of some of the key developments within each of the narratives, just very briefly. And I also did some quantification of the storylines as well, for kind of illustrative purposes. So I'll show those and we'll have a little think about how those maybe compare against each other. So maybe just to recap briefly over some of the ground that Pete's already covered. Within Resolve, we tend to focus on the consumption perspective rather than production perspective. So if in the production perspective we're thinking about all of those emissions that arise during production in the UK, we're thinking about things also where those goods and services are either consumed domestically or where they're exported as well. It's about what we produce in the UK that we're counting. And of course the consumption perspective then, irrespective of where the emissions are produced, we count them if those goods are finally consumed in the UK. And the difference between those two, I mean, obviously in both cases we're counting things that are domestically produced and consumed. So the difference between the two is often called the CO2 trade balance, and whether you're a net importer or exporter of emissions, of course, depends on which of the two figures is higher, your imports or outports, exports. So in the UK, our government has been reporting a reduction in emissions over the last couple of decades, which is true if you take the production perspective. And there have been, well, a lot of reasons for that. A couple of reasons include the dash for gas that we've had. So, for example, we've been replacing a lot of our coal electricity production with gas-fired power stations. And also over that period, there's been a lot of offshoring of heavy industry. So that reduced production perspective emissions. But in the case of consumption emissions, well, the dash for gas helps somewhat as well for consumption emissions if it's reducing the carbon intensity of electricity that's consumed here. But the offshoring of heavy industry, of course, if we're then importing those goods back to the UK, may in fact lead to higher emissions from, for example, less energy-efficient production processes and the increased transportation that's required to get those goods back to the UK market. So one kind of thought experiment early on in my kind of project was thinking about the impact of domestic targets in the UK. We've set some quite ambitious UK targets as part of the Climate Change Act. And if those targets were to be pursued, but not in the context of an effective international regime, could this in fact be something that leads to even more offshoring of heavy industry? So it looks very good from a production perspective, but makes things even worse from a consumption perspective. And again, just to recap on what Pete's already gone over, this distinction between direct emissions and embedded emissions when we're thinking about the consumption perspective. Direct emissions are those arising at the point of consumption, so typically gas use for heating or cooking, vehicle fuels. We also count electricity as one of those in our modelling because it's, although obviously the emissions actually occur upstream, it's treated as a kind of energy source by households and it's thought of in that way. So we treat it as a direct emissions category. And embedded emissions, obviously, are those goods and services where emissions occur upstream during production. So to break that down again into further category, if we think of the direct emissions, this is the blue bar at the bottom here in this chart, and then we think about those embedded emissions, but think about those which are due to production in the UK and those from production overseas, so imported embedded emissions. And in the model that Pete's described, Selma, the period of data that we have for our emissions modelling is 1992 to 2004. And you can see the trends here, although don't put the numbers up, but you can see the blue box. I mean, there's a very slow, gradual decline in emissions from direct emissions there. But the embedded emissions are growing, and imported embedded emissions in particular. So if we do just a really simple extrapolation out to 2030, which is the time horizon for my study, this is where we end up. So purely on present trends and, you know, other things being equal, that's where we get. So that's the case without any policy intervention or change of fuel sources and so on. What happens then if you do have a very strong UK policy agenda which aims to reduce obviously the blue and to some extent the red boxes there, but does nothing and may in fact exacerbate the growth of the orange box here, the imported emissions? So that was one of the sort of things that led to the scenario framework which I eventually developed, and here it is. So there are four scenarios here, and they're framed by two key uncertainties. The first one is the effectiveness or otherwise of the international regime around emissions and climate change. And the other axis here is the timing of the UK's transition, if indeed it goes ahead with one. And this is something that developed iteratively throughout the kind of interviewing process that I followed to develop this. So to begin with, for example, the transition related only to the UK, what if we do lots or what if we do nothing? And during the kind of interviewing phase, it became apparent, obviously, that it's quite inconceivable to have a world where the UK does all this stuff and nobody else does, like nobody in Europe, nobody. So that transition axis was expanded to think about European level developments overall, and the UK as part of that. And the other thing which I developed, because in 2009, once this project was underway, I attended a presentation by a launch of a report by UKIR, which is the UK Energy Research Centre. And that was the report on global oil depletion. And their estimate, by looking at several hundred peak oil studies, was that the peak in conventional oil certainly would happen sometime before 2030, with a significant risk that that would occur before 2020. So that's a significant enough event in energy terms, and also psychological terms and people's relation with energy. I wanted to introduce that in some way into the scenarios. So that's been used, if you like, as a test, as a challenge that gets applied across all four scenarios in the period from 2015 to 2020. And how each of the scenarios has developed up until that point determines the responses to that challenge and the direction that the scenarios follow from that point on. So just in brief, kind of one slide per scenario, I'll summarise these, and I'll say a bit in the end about where you can get access to the full kind of narratives. So in the case of better late than never, which is my top left scenario, so we have an effective international regime, but a late transition, so how does that add up? Well, what happens here is there's little significant change in efforts to tackle emissions up until 2020. When increasing calls for climate action combined with those rising fuel and commodity prices to bring things to a crisis point. And it's out of that crisis that international leaders build a consensus on a comprehensive programme of emissions cuts. And although there's little improvement in the carbon intensity of UK lifestyles before that crisis, the securing of a global deal instills a sense of common purpose, and that encourages proactive behavioural change. In the top right scenario, which not coincidentally is the green coloured one, called All Together Now, what happens here is that voluntary climate action by different countries, including through green jobs programmes as part of a recovery, lays the groundwork for a comprehensive and equitable global deal in 2015. And the cooperative approach observed at that international level is reflected in behavioural change undertaken at the household level. In trading woes, which is at the bottom right, where we have an early transition, we have an early start in the UK and in Europe, but this doesn't combine with a comprehensive global emissions regime. What we have is unilateral climate action by the EU, which is intended to draw further commitments from other parties. But with no such action forthcoming by 2015, the EU threatens the use of trade measures. And after a period of heightened political tension and economic slowdown, a compromise is reached. And the result is a series of bilateral emissions targets, but which remain insufficient to avoid dangerous climate change. And the UK public are cautiously optimistic at the outset, but lack of commensurate international action dampens enthusiasm for pro-environmental behaviour change. And finally, we have Over the Edge, which is there's late action here, and when that action does come, it's not in the form of a comprehensive cooperative emissions regime. So we have little effort on emissions reduction. The global economy is exposed to increasing fuel prices towards 2020. And with intensified social pressure to reduce fuel prices and unable to work cooperatively on establishing an equitable emissions regime, countries instead pursue divergent, often conflicting, energy security policies. and the persistence of fossil fuel extraction as part of those policies extinguishes any hope of a low-carbon transition and leads to international conflict and economic crisis. So those are, in a kind of very broad brush sense, the four outlines of the scenarios. And then in terms of quantifying those, maybe just to say a little bit about the modelling process, because Pete's described some of the other models in Resolve, including Selma, which gave us the emissions estimates. And there is a fourth model that we use in Resolve called ELISA, which is environmental, lifestyle, and emissions scenario analysis, I think. And what that model does is take 45 years worth of historical data for UK household expenditure and for 16 different categories of goods and services, so like gas or electricity, and also things like communications, clothing and footwear. So for those, each of those 16 categories, we look at the changes in expenditure over that 45-year period. And we also then look at changes in prices, and we match the two to try and get a sense of the impact that price changes are having on people's expenditure. And we also look at income changes over that period, and that gives us a sense of the impact that rising or falling incomes are having on changes in expenditure per category. But what the model is, which is really the kind of unique part of it, is that it also, aside from those economic factors, assesses the impact of exogenous non-economic factors in driving expenditure that can't be accounted for through income and price changes. So, and it then attaches the data from Selma in the form of the emissions estimates. So what we have then is a model that we can really kind of play with in a few different ways. So we have historical trends that suggest what happens when you play with prices, price elasticity, and similarly what happens when you play with incomes. But also we have this broad trend, which isn't very well described, it's a bit of a black box, but this thing called non-economic factors. But we can also look at specific categories and see that, okay, for this category, let's say clothing or communications, it seems that despite incomes and prices being constant, say, there's something here that's driving an upward trend in expenditure for that category. So that's interesting. Now that could be structural things like, for example, the introduction of a nationwide gas network. So there's no change in prices necessarily, it's just that something becomes available to households to purchase. Or it could be that there are value changes and impacts on people's behaviours as part of that kind of black box as well. So what we have is a model which has historical trends which inform the quantification that I've used. So I start with those historical trends for all four scenarios. And then according to the different storylines here, I play with assumptions around prices, around potentially the impact of pro-environmental behaviour change, and emissions intensity at production. Production sense to get four trajectories, which I'll show the pair now. So in 2010, it's the same data, they all match. And the dark bars at the bottom are the direct emissions, and the lighter bars are the indirect. And the colour coding here is from top left, so there was better late than never, and then altogether now our trading woes scenario, and then over the edge. And these are emissions, not expenditures. So for example, just to pick out a couple of kind of highlights here, the pink bars, if you like, over the edge, you see those kind of beginning to rise inexorably up until 2025, and that's the point at which the short-term measures to drill and get as much gas out of whatever parts of the ground we can kind of begin to grind to a halt. So there's been a short-term kind of sustaining of the economy over that five-year period, but for at least to further international conflict and to economic crisis. So expenditure falls in this category, in this scenario, as do emissions. But by 2030, it's still the scenario with the highest consumption emissions of all four. The yellow and the blue scenarios there, the first and the third one, is interesting because those have quite distinct narratives, quite distinct storyline pathways. In scenario A, nothing much happens behaviourally until 2020, and then there's this kind of collective effort, and emissions begin to reduce by the end of the period. Scenario C, instead, there's this sense that the EU actually does step out, maybe increases its target to 30% by 2020, takes a series of measures. But what happens in this scenario from 2020 is that as part of those trade agreements being negotiated, cheaper, more carbon-intensive imports are able to flood back into the EU market, so any progress kind of stalls over that period. So you get to the point where the emissions are roughly the same by the end, although the storylines are very different. And scenario the blue one altogether now. It's the most optimistic and yet still has consumption emissions around 600 megatons CO2 equivalent. So this is, you know, even in the most ambitious scenario, at least that I've portrayed, we still have a fairly substantial level of emissions associated with household consumption in the UK. And maybe just to say something about that and how diverse those trajectories are or are not. Part of that modelling process then, playing with prices, playing with incomes, there are kind of historically established price effects or elasticities and income elasticities associated with those. So really I can play with the price figures, but then I allow the model to tell us how we expect people's consumption to change accordingly. The exogenous non-economic factors or all the other stuff, which might be structural, behavioural, all those kind of things, that black box, that impacts directly. That is, if you like, the effect directly. There's no elasticity that it goes through. So if the trend over the last 20, 30, 40 years has been for a particular category that, aside from economic factors, there's some pressure pushing expenditure up, then that's a long-term trend. And what I've done in my work, rather than just get to a point where we say, right, let's assume behaviour changes overnight and that starts having a negative effect, instead I assume there's some degree of inertia as part of the kind of social processes that might lead to behaviour change, value change through to behaviour change. So even in that most optimistic scenario where I describe a sense of cooperation and willingness to engage in proactive behaviour change, there still takes some time in coming to get those kind of emission savings there. And if you wanted to extend those out for another 10 or 20 years, say, then okay, you need to further develop the storylines to see what happens, but you can imagine by that stage the trajectories could be much more significantly diverse. So some of the kind of implications of ongoing uncertainties. The international emissions regime was an interesting one, and it framed the scenarios because half of the interviews that I did in this process were leading up to Copenhagen, and the other half of the interviews I did were post-Copenhagen. And the sense of optimism and necessity followed by complete disillusion and cynicism following the fallout of that was quite significant. So it was, even in the most optimistic scenario, as you've seen, the global agreement comes about not until 2015. It was a bit depressing. Hopefully, who knows, maybe things have changed, I don't know. The European economic and energy policy kind of situation at the moment, obviously, I mean, energy policy most directly, we have, I think, at present, a 20% target for Europe by 2020, reduction in emissions. And there was talk that we should increase that to 30%, that in fact, because of the recession, it's not even that ambitious a target anymore. We should all agree to this. And I think the latest I've seen is a suggestion that there will be some kind of compromise around 25%, but I think yet to be enshrined in legislation. And alongside that, the impact of all the various economic crises and uncertainties around Europe, the Eurozone, and obviously coming in from outside of Europe now as well. How all of those things are going to play out is anybody's guess, really. And this is one thing that you make your peace with very early on in scenario planning processes, is that you're not going to predict the future. All you can hope to do is maybe depict four kind of quite distinct and tangible versions of plausible futures. But certainly, any assessment of probability is really quite tricky. And food and fuel prices is most interesting to me because that was something I kind of offset by 5 years. This will be once the economy recovers, we get to about 2015, demand for fossil fuels recovers, demand for food and other commodities recovers, all these things kind of combine, price pressures increase. And then even as I was developing the scenarios, we had, you know, various kind of protests and unrest in the Middle East and North African countries, motivated in part in those places by high food prices, knocking on, in our case, to high energy prices and so on. So all of these things kind of co-evolve in a complex adaptive way, but that came through as a clear kind of surprise for me that this happens even as we're trundling through this kind of precarious half and half recovery. So all of these all of the scenarios, the full narratives and the quantification, and also what I've spoken about in terms of how I framed it and what led to that framing, and discussion around some of the implications, including from others in the group like Tim Jackson. That's all kind of been packaged at the moment into a report which we'll launch in August called Consuming Carbon. And just to give you a kind of idea of what form the narratives take, although I don't expect you to read that, but this is for better late than never. And you can see I've broken those narratives down into distinct timelines. So the bar at the top left shows you this is our first five-year period. And here's what happens at the global level, and also what's happening in the UK in terms of policy and social developments. And then I have four specific categories of consumption here, which are around the home, so energy used directly, heating and electricity, the food that we eat specifically, and then two transport categories. One of those is day-to-day transport for commuting and driving kids around and so on. And the final category is holiday travelling, so aviation in particular. And those four categories were drawn out of much earlier work by the Sustainable Consumption Roundtable, where they asked around 100 members members of the public in a workshop to characterise how they think about their energy use and the environmental impact. And those four categories were the ones that they arrived at from that workshop. So I've used those to characterise some of the key developments that take place. So that happens period by period, and then we have the kind of summary of emissions and discussion at the end. And all of the yucky quantification, all the full numbers for every quarter, for every category, for every scenario, those will be available as a supplementary download as well. And yeah, so thank you very much.